This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You are on Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. I'm Macca, and my co-host this morning is the CEO of Joy, Ange Barry.
Pleasure to be here with you, Macca.
It's lovely to have you here. It's great to hear your voice on the airwaves again.
Thank you.
Our next guest is Catherine Bennett, a long-standing SatMag guest, Chair of Epidemiology at Deakin University. Good morning, Catherine. How is your Saturday?
Good morning to you both. It's looking a bit better now that we've had somewhat more encouraging news from our weekly update on COVID.
Yes, and that's where we had a discussion before the show in terms of effectively there's no rules about what we need to do, where we need to wear masks other than, you know, I suppose in a medical environment, and what to do if you do contract COVID. Are you disturbed by this?
Not disturbed. By the time we were into our winter wave, which was our last big wave, the BA5 wave, we'd already eased back, or were easing back on most of those rules anyway. We'd reached a point where we still had isolation in place, but that was also eased towards the end. And I think it's reflecting, you know, two things. One is that you have to transition away from rules at some point, particularly when you're not in a position to enforce them. But the second is that we now can't control community transmission in the way that we could in the past. Mm. But that, because this version of the virus is just, you know, every successive wave we've had within the Omicron, but even from Omicron at the start, it spreads too efficiently, too quickly to contain it in the way we used to before. But the upside is that we have progressively, we did hold it off long enough so that we could build immunity quite safely, most people having had infection with Omicron, not the previous variants, and also after they've had a vaccination. So we have kind of gone through an important transition over this last year that's helped us get to a point where we are seeing another surge in cases, but we are not seeing the same translation to people in hospital or death rates. And that's the pattern they've seen overseas as well. So that's encouraging news.
Catherine, Ange here. Joy's played a role we're quite proud of in encouraging COVID vaccine uptake within our community. I've noticed of late, speaking to friends and family, there is a little bit of questioning about, well, how many vaccines are there now? Which number am I up to? What should I do next? I'm wondering, you know, at what point do we move to, say, an annual vaccine? Is that even the plan? And, you know, what should we be doing right now? Because I think that there, you know, I couldn't tell you, I think I'm up to number four at the moment, but, you know, it's like, okay, what should we be doing right now with our, you know, our vaccine status?
It's a really good question, because we've had some changes with the vaccines available, but not to the schedule, not saying to people, you know, what they're eligible for. And so we probably are going to move towards a winter dose, and that was the hope, that we'd had a winter dose last year for the people who were a bit more vulnerable. Older people, or people, anyone over 30 could potentially have it, but it was particularly people over 50 who were encouraged to have it, or with any underlying illness or medication that would potentially challenge their ability to mount a response to a vaccination, or, you know, the risk of serious illness.
Yeah.
What the hope was, that then the next dose would come before next winter. So, you know, as we make our way through summer, so in the new year, they're still holding off for that. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, the first booster is really critical. That's the one that shifts you from the primary two courses into a level of immunity that works against Omicron. And so that was really important for people of all ages, because it helps reduce that risk of serious illness for the older, or people with underlying illness. For younger people, that booster dose is also associated with a reduced risk of long COVID.
Yes.
And so it might be up to 50%. So we are encouraging everyone to make sure that if they've not had their first booster, that they do think about that, particularly while exposure's high again at the moment.
Yep.
And that's for anyone who's 16 and older. If they're 18 and older, they can get these new bivalent vaccines as well that actually cover Omicron specifically.
Okay.
So the next dose, the fourth dose, it's optional for people 30 to 50. we're not seeing, we're still seeing a pattern where the people ending up in hospital with COVID or for their COVID are people who haven't yet had that fourth dose, who are eligible or haven't yet been vaccinated. They're the ones overrepresented. So that's what I watch. If that changes, then they might bring forward another dose.
Another one. Okay, so when we say the fourth dose and we talk about the first booster is number three, is that correct? If we think about, you know, we all had our first COVID shot, then we went back for a second, and then I think the language went to booster. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the third dose was actually the booster.
Right.
Some people who are immunocompromised had three doses as part of their primary course, so it got a bit confusing for a while there.
Yeah.
But for most people, you know, you can actually track your record. You can go and see how many doses you have. And for people who are 30 and older, they are eligible for a fourth dose or a second booster.
Mm-hmm.
But particularly people over 50, it's still recommended. If people haven't had that one, that's the one that we would really suggest, because that can still protect people from hospital who have a reduced risk of ending up unwell, but it's still there. And so that fourth dose was important and continues to be important.
I'd really back that up to Catherine. A friend of mine hasn't had her fourth dose and just has caught COVID for, I think, the second or third time and is really quite ill. And it was unexpected. And she's, you know, she's said to us all, and she's actually a nurse herself, and she said, get that fourth dose.
Mm. I mean, yeah. I think that there's a little bit of, I think, complacency that people, because effectively there are no restrictions and it's not being talked about, but if you look at hospitalisations, you look at long COVID, we should actually be thinking about this a lot more. And I know people are fatigued, Catherine, but and government doesn't really want to talk about it, particularly when there's an election on. But do you think, you know, this ambivalence or that people aren't thinking about it, is it going to get away from us again? You know, is you know, the wave that's coming now, is this going to get stronger?
No, look, I hope not. I absolutely agree with you there, Macca. I think, you know, we've talked about this in the past as well. When you move away from rules, you have to replace it with something so that people realise that the removal of rules isn't saying, well, it's all gone now.
Yeah.
It's saying we now have to manage this in a sustainable way. And that really was a handover from a kind of a political voice managing it to the health departments. But that voice has been quiet. And so, you know, particularly in Victoria, we haven't heard a lot.
Mm.
In other states, there's well, in fact, all states, including Victoria, our chief health officer has come out with the same messages around the things that people should do. I think we could have clearer messaging about what it means when our infection rates go up, and we're talking about these surges, how that translates to every individual is the risk that if you have 10 people over to your house, the risk of one of them now being infectious and not knowing it has gone up. Or, you know, how many people do you have to come across before one of them is likely to be infectious? And I think as that changes, that would help people sort of think about whether they have their party inside or outside, or whether they sit out at a cafe, or whether they wear a mask when they go into a supermarket. But I think the other thing is we've got a lot of people who remain very anxious, who really bought into the fear messaging early on, but now find it really hard to evaluate risk. And so we have to bring those people with us as well. And people often say, well, you don't know who is vulnerable. Like, you know, how do you protect vulnerable people if they just look like us anyway?
Mm.
But you know, actually, the people that are aware of their risk being heightened, they're the ones wearing masks, particularly when they're on public transport. And if you're around someone who's already got a mask on, put a mask on, because it just helps that person, whether it's because they're anxious about it or whether they've got an absolutely different level of risk, then we should be looking after each other as well at this time.
Yep. Catherine, we've got a great question from John. John's asked us, why does the UK have a lower infection rate and a lower death rate in the last 6 months? Have they built up better immunity? Is that what's happening over there?
Yeah, so it's what we call the hybrid immunity. They did eventually get their immunisation rates up as well. They're a bit slower than other parts of the world, like Australia. We did get there before the end of 21. But, of course, they've had a history of waves. They've had high infection rates. And what they found with the current wave we're still in, when they started to see the surge about, you know, a few weeks before us, they go out and they actively test people in the community, so they've got a pretty good idea about what's happening. But in fact, they found the infection rate itself was much lower than in previous waves. Okay. And that probably is because you've built up that level of immunity. And certainly then, you know, it's not translating to hospital in the same way. It's the one advantage, even though we're seeing all these subvariants of Omicron and we can see reinfection, and every time a new subvariant is in the mix, that pushes our numbers up again. At the same time, they are still related to each other. They're all versions of Omicron. And so we do have some cross-reactive protection, particularly against severe illness, that is helping us manage the community transmission in a different way than we could have pre-vaccination and pre-widespread community transmission. So we are seeing that progressive shift as long as we've got Omicron as the dominant variant. And we've had that for a year now. We didn't see that in the first 2 years. Mm. But Omicron kind of nudges everything else out. It boosts our immunity in a way that stops other variants getting a foothold. But, you know, it allows Omicron to continue to circulate in the community. So it's here to stay. We can't control it with our other measures, as China's now also discovering. But at the same time, thankfully, we've changed as well in terms of our immunity, and that's helping. But the antivirals shouldn't be underestimated either. And we saw in the winter wave when the antiviral use went up, that really did provide that backstop that helped turn around that terrible death rate that we were seeing. And likewise with the current surge, you could see the antiviral prescriptions go up really quickly. And so that's working quite well now to also save people from having a severe illness or ending up in hospital. So we still want people to be thinking about that. If they've still got any vulnerability to serious illness, antivirals can make the difference if they do get a breakthrough infection. And that's happening across the world too. And that's certainly helping break that, you know, decouple the relationship between infection in the population and how that translates to serious illness.
Do you think, Catherine, it's time, or, you know, that it would be a good idea for a campaign to a more out there, or, you know, a more visible campaign pointing out, you know, how antivirals can help, but also, you know, have you had another jab when you're in a group that, you know, we think the risk is greater? Do you think it would be a good idea to start another campaign?
Yeah, look, I do. And there's been a bit of that, but it's not, I don't know, it's not coming across in the way that seems to be changing behaviour. We haven't seen a big shift in vaccination uptake. And for younger people, particularly that concern about long COVID, if they've already had infections and haven't had long COVID, they probably feel like they're protected.
Yeah.
But, you know, we don't actually have detailed understanding of when a healthy young person has multiple infections, what that does for long COVID. There is some suggestion it might increase risk. So you might get away with a few infections and be fine. It might be the third or fourth infection where you have a, you know, an issue. And in fact, the booster, for people who haven't had a booster at all, the booster can help reduce the risk of any infection for a while, not for a long time, but it helps give you a bit of a window. And while we're still learning about things like long COVID, anything people can do to reduce infection risk is a good thing. Because, you know, it might be being extra cautious, but at the same time, if we discover that, yeah, it's actually, you know, having multiple infections changes your risk, and you only have to listen to people living with long COVID to understand, you know, how terrible that can be and how long that can persist. So sort of minor protections can actually make a difference. So I do think making sure people are aware of that. We've had the submissions going into the long COVID and repeat infection Senate inquiry, and that's going to be really helpful. But essentially what it's highlighting is the fact that this is a really complex area to understand. People have very different range of symptoms. It overlaps with a lot of other conditions. So there's a lot of work to be done in that space. But getting that information as we learn more about long COVID out to the community is going to be really important too, so that people understand the risks, understand more about long COVID, and also, you know, why it's important to still have this front of mind when we're making our day-to-day choices about what we do and how we do it.
Great. Look, thanks for filling in a few gaps for us there, Catherine. It's really important, you know, for people to understand what the issues are, what the challenges are, what their options are. I want to thank you for making yourself available again on a Saturday, but thank you for your work. You've really helped our, you know, helped our listeners you know, every time we speak with you, I think our listeners learn something new or understand something a bit better. And
I think Joy's done a fantastic job promoting the vaccines in particular. Really, I'm sure, made a big difference. So
thank you, Catherine, for the work you're doing.
Thank you. You have a great Saturday. And if you haven't voted, Catherine, go and get a democracy sausage or a cake or whatever.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. We were speaking with Catherine Bennett, Chair of Epidemiology at Deakin University. Catherine made herself available dozens of times during COVID. I want to thank her for that. It was always really great to talk to her. And you are on Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. Macca and Ange, stay with us. There's more.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.